Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Yifat Suskind of the women's rights group Madre, who discusses Iraq's new draft constitution that threatens to roll back women's rights in a nation that was once the most secular in the Persian Gulf region. Bruce Shapiro of The Nation magazine, who assesses the character and known record of John Roberts, President Bush's Supreme Court nominee. And Barbara Olshansky, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines new revelations on the FBI's surveillance of progressive activist groups in the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Just an hour after President George W. Bush and Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh signed a cooperation agreement on expanding ties on civilian nuclear power, they sat down for a state dinner at a table with General Electric CEO Jeff Immelt. According to Reuters, GE will likely profit greatly from the nuclear deal. The industrial giant is the only U.S. company that still makes nuclear reactors and has been frozen out of the Indian market since 1974. GE is hoping to provide technical and maintenance services for India's existing nuclear plants and to secure contracts to build new nuclear plants in India, the world's second fastest growing economy. In response, Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey, a strong arms control advocate, has condemned the nuclear deal. Markey blasted the cooperation agreement as a rogue, shoot-from-the-hip move that puts the interests of industry ahead of our national security. In recent months, the Bush administration has pushed the expansion of nuclear power in emerging markets. The U.S. Export-Import Bank has approved $5 billion in loans to British-owned Westinghouse Electric and its American suppliers to build four new nuclear plants in China. As a token of friendship, a few years ago, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il sent a rare ginseng root as a birthday present to Reverend Sun Myung-moon, head of the Unification Church and self-proclaimed Messiah. According to the American Prospect magazine, this is only one in a series of gifts between Moon and Kim and his father, Kim Il-sung, over the past 15 years. The friendship has allowed Moon operatives to invest millions of dollars in North Korea, including a 2003 exclusive $55 million contract to manufacture vehicles for the North Korean government, one of the most repressive in the world. Moon's courtship of the elder Kim started after the fall of the Berlin Wall. In November 1991, Moon made a visit to Pyongyang and met with the elder Kim. According to longtime Moon aide, Colonel Bo Hee Pak, the two talked of Korean unification and other projects. In April 1992, a delegation of the Moon-owned Washington Times made a trip to North Korea for the 80th birthday of the aging North Korean dictator. Then managing editor Jesset Shiner, at the time a member of the Unification Church, obtained the first interview with Kim in 20 years. She asked softball questions and wrote that Kim was in reality an elder statesman and not the reclusive, dogmatic dictator he is usually portrayed in the West. A Japanese newspaper now reports that four members of the Unification Church aided North Korea in their 1994 purchase of old Soviet-era submarines, allegedly to be used for scrap metal. More recently, defense analysts such as Jane's Defense Weekly say the sub sales were vital in teaching North Korea how to stabilize its missile launch tubes. The 16th Pastors for Peace Friendship Caravan to Cuba was stopped at the U.S.-Mexican border by enforcement officers from the U.S. Commerce Department on July the 21st. 43 boxes of aid were seized, including 12 computers, cables, keyboards, modems, calculators, and two printers the group says were intended for Cuban children. Seven caravanistas have remained on the border in Hidalgo, Texas, to bring international attention and to demand the U.S. government release the equipment for delivery to Cuba. On July the 22nd, most of the 11-vehicle caravan was inspected and the remaining 123 members crossed the border and continued their journey to Cuba. Pastors for Peace, headed by Reverend Lucius Walker, has made this annual event purposely without the federal license required by the U.S. government, calling the U.S. embargo against Cuba an immoral policy. In 1996, 400 computers were seized and several of the caravanistas embarked on a 94-day hunger strike in McAllen, Texas. Eventually, the U.S. Customs Department released the computers. Reverend Walker stated that what is unusual about this seizure is that it was not carried out by the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, as in the past, but rather from the U.S. Commerce Department. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The current draft of Iraq's new constitution threatens to replace a very progressive set of laws regarding women's rights with a new document that subordinates women's human rights to religious Sharia law. A draft of the constitution is due to be voted on by the current Iraqi government by August 15th. Press reports indicate that a chapter in a draft of the new constitution would require that issues involving marriage, divorce, and inheritance be transferred to Islamic religious courts, where women have little or no rights. Upon hearing about these controversial provisions of the Constitution, several hundred women and men took to the streets in Baghdad to protest the growing influence of Islamic fundamentalism in a country that historically had been the most secular in the Middle East. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Yifat Suskind, Associate Director of MADRE, a women's human rights organization that works with women across the globe and in Iraq. She explains that Iraqi women have struggled for and won rights not held by women in the strict religious monarchies that rule many nations in the Persian Gulf region. Suskind also describes Iraqi women's response to this new threat, as well as the role American political leaders have played on the issue of Iraqi women's equality.
Under Saddam Hussein, women in Iraq had rights that were not only much better than women in most other countries in the Middle East, but by certain criteria, better rights than we have today here in the United States. For example, Iraqi women under the former government had about 5 years guaranteed maternity leave. And that's not to say that Saddam Hussein was some kind of a feminist or that he cared in particular about women and families. That was a very brutal government. But they did, ironically, implement policies that were beneficial to women and protected women's rights. And that was a function of a set of policies that were used to generate support in the society for the Iraqi state and for his government. They had legislated and enjoyed for decades relatively progressive set of rights that were protected by the government. Iraqi women were a very vibrant and important part of the labor force under the former government. I think about 40% of the public sector workforce were women. Women were highly educated. Women participated within the confines of what was a very undemocratic government. Women participated in public life quite fully.
And what about rights regarding divorce and child custody?
Iraqi women, until the U.S. invasion and occupation, were ruled by family law that was implemented in 1959, a family status law that was not the brainchild of Saddam Hussein's regime, but again, something that women, after British colonization and before Saddam Hussein took power, fought for, lobbied for, and Saddam Hussein's government, you know, kept it on the books. It was more or less implemented. And it was, on paper and also in practice, you know, not a perfect law, and few laws are perfect, but it was light years ahead of what's being proposed now. It was a law that, for example, you know, treated all Iraqi citizens with one law. The current law, one of the most dangerous things about it, is that it proposes to legislate people differently depending on their sect or their religion. And what progressive and democratic-minded people in Iraq are very worried about is that, you know, to apply different laws to different people in one country, that is going to exacerbate tensions, for example, between Shiites and Sunnis, between Christians and Muslims, that all people need to be treated equally and under one law in one country.
What's been the response of women in Iraq to this threat?
Well, as soon as the draft constitution was leaked, there was a demonstration of a few hundred people in Baghdad, mostly women and some democratically minded men. People have issued a call for international support. I know there's a call from the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, which is an organization that Madre works with, for people to write open letters to the U.S. administration and to the United Nations and remind the world, remind government officials that to create what's called a democracy without rights for half of the population really makes a mockery of democracy and of the suffering that people in Iraq have endured so far.
You know, we hear in this country that U.S. occupation forces, first under Proconsul Paul Bremer and now under his successors, are the ones promoting women's rights. Are they the good guys here?
Well, you know, one thing that a lot of people in this country don't know is that Iraq was an overwhelmingly secular country until the social fabric of Iraq started really unraveling as a result of the U.S.-led economic siege of the 1990s. And since the invasion and the occupation, things have gotten even worse. The vacuum that was created by the overthrow of Saddam Hussein's government, even though people in Iraq overwhelmingly were very happy to see him go, kind of opened the door for right-wing religious extremists to try to step in. And the U.S., rather than fight that trend and support democratically minded people in Iraq, actually helped empower the religious right. Paul Bremer, who headed up the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority, personally handpicked quite a few, I think it was four or five, religious clerics to sit on the Iraqi Governing Council. These were men who had an openly stated commitment to doing exactly what we've seen now, which is making sure that women's rights are violated in the Constitution. They publicly said that that was their intent, and he put them on the Governing Council. Now, the national body that we have now is the next incarnation of the Iraqi government, so it's not the same bunch of people, but he put those people in power. Several of them have stayed in power, and that ball really got rolling under direct U.S. rule.
What are the ramifications for the rights of women if this new constitution is passed?
The potential to undermine and violate women's human rights is really very grave. I mean, it could include denial of the right to education, to employment, to freedom, to travel, to property inheritance, to child custody. I mean, things that make up the basics of our lives, you know, and issues that are terrible human rights violations for a lot of women in the world, things like forced early marriage and compulsory religious dress and domestic violence not being criminalized. And what this law does is to open the door to people who are essentially self-appointed religious leaders inflicting human rights violations in the name of the law.
That was Yifat Suskind of Madre. For more information on women's rights issues around the world, call them at area code 212-627-0444 or visit the group's website at www.madre.org. With the resignation of Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the long-expected battle over the future of the Supreme Court was joined. President Bush's nominee to fill the vacancy, Federal Appeals Court Judge John Roberts, is a dedicated conservative with a long history of work in Republican administrations. With only 2 years as a federal judge in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, Roberts has a short record with which to assess his judicial philosophy. But in a landmark decision issued just one day after being interviewed for the Supreme Court by President Bush, Roberts and his colleagues on the D.C. Circuit Court decided against according Geneva Convention protections to prisoners held in the U.S. detention camp at Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba. An important clue as to Roberts' view on abortion rights can be seen in a 1991 legal brief signed by the then Deputy Solicitor General in President Bush's father's administration, where he stated, "We continue to believe that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided and should be overruled." Despite Roberts' repeated denials that he was a member of the controversial Federalist Society, press reports revealed that he was listed as member of the 1997-98 steering committee of the conservative legal organization's D.C. chapter. As Senate confirmation hearings approach in September, battle lines have already been drawn over the release of memos and documents written by Roberts during his tenure as Deputy Solicitor General in the late 80s and early 90s. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Shapiro, former director of the Nation Institute Supreme Court Watch, who assesses the character and known record of John Roberts.
He is somebody who has a lot of friends on both sides of the aisle in Washington. He's taken great care to craft a career, to craft a public persona of someone amiable and bipartisan in demeanor, not a flamethrower in personal style, not someone given to grand statements about the law. And that's the image that, the Bush administration has, I think, sought to promote. And I think, actually, that's an image which some senators, unfortunately, have shown signs of, buying. I think a different Roberts begins to emerge if you look carefully at his record. You know, he hasn't been on the bench that long, so there's not a huge number of cases. But even in the short time that he's been on the bench, there are a few indications of, something different than this amiable, bipartisan pragmatist. You know, you don't even have to go to huge sweeping cases. My favorite in some ways involves nothing more complex than a French fry. 2000, a 12-year-old girl was eating a French fry on the Washington, D.C. Metro. There happened to be a zero-tolerance crackdown at that particular time, and some police officers took it into their heads to arrest this 12-year-old for eating a French fry, put her in handcuffs, and take her down to the squad room where she was held in jail for 3 hours until her mother came and picked her up. And actually, it was a conservative group, an outfit called the Rutherford Institute in Virginia, which thought this was outrageous and sued, saying that this poor child had been denied equal protection. An adult would just have gotten a ticket. She was essentially abused because she was a child. It made it up to the appeals court, and interestingly enough, Judge Roberts found for the police. Judge Roberts fell over himself a little bit to say it's too bad this had to happen to a child, but he went on to say the police acted reasonably in an effort to deter juvenile delinquency. You know, juvenile delinquency from eating a French fry, this is something which even, I think, folks in red states would take exception to, and it suggests a somewhat more ideological and rigid individual. One day after his crucial meeting with President Bush, the appeals court, including Judge Roberts, a three-judge panel, handed down a very troubling ruling reinstating military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay Prison, saying that the courts have no jurisdiction over these tribunals and that the Geneva Conventions don't apply if the administration doesn't want them to apply. It was a kind of stunning reassertion of the president's power to act above the law. What does this have in common, though, you may ask, with this Washington, D.C. French fry case? Well, in both cases, Judge Roberts showed himself to be not really a conservative, but rather someone in love with the executive branch of government, with enhancing the power of the executive branch of government. And more than anything else, I think that's who we're beginning to see.
Bruce, I wanted to ask you about Supreme Court nominee John Roberts' history as the deputy to Solicitor General Ken Starr at a certain point in time. What can you tell us about his views and writings and expositions in front of courts on presidential power, promoting school prayer, restricting abortion?
You know, abortion rights in particular are clearly a hot-button issue right now. And in 1991... working for Ken Starr, Judge Roberts went before the Supreme Court and argued in a famous case called Russ versus Sullivan, the so-called gag rule case, in which the federal government was trying to deny family planning funds to any clinic that discussed abortion as an option with its clients. And the case was ultimately thrown out, and in the course of that, Deputy Solicitor General Roberts wrote what is now the most famous footnote in Washington to his brief, saying in quite unequivocal terms that Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided and should be overturned. This fit in with a spectrum of fairly extreme legal arguments that Judge Roberts made on behalf of the Bush administration and on the Reagan administration earlier.
What do we know about the Democrats' game plan for dealing with Judge John Roberts, many of them very kind to him when the nomination was first announced? But what do you hear now about what might be going on in the Senate regarding his nomination?
There are a number of different Democratic plans out there. The so-called gang of of 14, or the seven Democrats of the Gang of 14, including Connecticut's Joe Lieberman, have been sort of dancing around the Roberts nomination, trying to find a way of supporting him without annoying core Democratic constituencies too much. I think there are a number of senators who are trying to decide, is this issue worth fighting? Can we get anywhere with this? And I think, in part, there is now the beginning of an understanding of what's at stake, a beginning of an understanding that there are profound questions of the balance of powers in this nomination, some important questions beginning to emerge about Judge Roberts' credibility. We have to remember that at this point, in some other highly contentious nominations, no one had any idea of the degree of controversy. There's a long way to go. We have an interesting road in front of us.
That was Bruce Shapiro, whose Nation magazine article, The Stakes in Roberts' Nomination, can be read online at www.thenation.com. Under the guise of fighting terrorism, the FBI has monitored the activities of U.S. civil liberties, anti-war, and environmental organizations. A lawsuit brought by activist groups charging that the FBI has targeted critics of the Bush administration forced the Justice Department to reveal that the FBI has amassed more than 3,500 pages of documents on progressive American advocacy organizations. Thus far, the FBI has identified 1,173 pages related to the American Civil Liberties Union and 2,383 pages detailing surveillance of the environmental group Greenpeace. Other documents provide evidence of the Bureau's monitoring of peace groups, such as the National Anti-Iraq War Coalition, United for Peace and Justice, that had organized a series of large protests at last August's Republican National Convention in New York City. The FBI denies that its investigation of groups critical of President Bush are designed to quell free speech, but rather to prevent disruptive or criminal behavior. However, representatives of the groups targeted charge that the FBI's monitoring of their legal and constitutionally protected activities amounts to an abuse of power. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Barbara Olshansky, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who takes a critical look at the FBI's surveillance of dissidents and what she believes is the resulting chilling effect on free speech.
This is a very interesting and, I think, relatively new event in the United States where straight First Amendment groups that are really on free speech right grounds and anchored in the Constitution are being targeted for, you know, infiltration and surveillance on the notion that all of these groups are or could become terrorist organizations given the tactics that certain groups use. In other words, the government has started thinking that everyone that opposes its policies in any way is likely to become, you know, sort of a bomb-throwing anarchist. And that is how Justice Department and other people from the administration are talking about these straightforward free speech groups, you know, that have long records of being in the public discourse here in the United States.
What can you tell us about how the FBI has collected these documents? Are they surveilling them through electronics? Are they infiltrating the organization's membership or leadership? Do we know anything about what's happening?
Very hard to say how these things are collected. The government has actually stated openly, the Anti-Terrorism Task Force has stated this, as well as the FBI, that they are now regularly infiltrating organizations because they feel like the only way to truly know what's going on is if they have somebody inside. And so this is clearly one way that they are doing this, but there is a whole host of other ways that they're doing it. And you know, lest people think that it's only through sneak and peek warrants or roving wiretaps under the Patriot Act, there's a lot of other means that are available to the government to collect this information. And it's coming from a wide range of sources, some of which the United States is regularly now purchasing from commercial entities, from commercial organizations, and They'll find out about what your membership is in particular organizations, and they'll be able to collect that data because it's collected on surveys and all different means. And then they aggregate data from public sources. And then they're also, of course, issuing all kinds of requests for information from all kinds of organizations. And very frequently, we now know that they don't actually invoke the provision of any particular law. They make an informal request, and occasionally organizations have voluntarily provided this information.
Barbara, the groups targeted by the FBI certainly believe they are under political surveillance for their activities, but the FBI has said they're not monitoring the political activities of activist groups, and that any intelligence gathering activities related to political protests are intended to prevent disruptive and criminal activity at demonstrations, not to quell free speech. How do you assess that statement by the FBI?
Well, you know, it's ridiculous because, of course, there's all these underlying assumptions, which is that all of these groups are groups which have a predisposition towards violence and destructive activities, which is not true, and that every group that engages in any free speech activity is going to have that same proclivity, you know, the same tendency to do violence. To think that the presence and surveillance by all these law enforcement organizations is not going to have a chilling effect is just, you know, has just been proven wrong by history. And so it just doesn't really make any sense from what we know about how, you know, the First Amendment has operated in this country and how attempts to circumscribe free speech have affected people. You know, when we know that they're listening to what we're saying and that they're looking at what we're reading, at some point people start to internalize that notion and second-guess themselves. Do I want to take this book out, learning about Osama bin Laden? Because someone might get a hold of that record. And then you say, you know what, I don't really need to read it anyway. And, of course, we all start to internalize all of that stuff, whether it's at a conscious level or more deeply buried. It's something that we know happens and that's been proven to happen. So it's just not honest to say that these surveillance activities don't have a chilling effect on what people are going to say and do.
That was Barbara Olshansky, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.